Hello and welcome to episode 44 of Exploring Environmental History. I'm Jan Oosthoek. 2012 marks the 50th anniversary of the publication of Rachel Carson's book Silent Spring. This publication is often regarded as the beginning of the modern environmental movement, in particular in the United States. Silent Spring first appeared in a series of three articles comprising about one-third of the book in the New Yorker in the summer of 1962 and was published in its entirety as a book later that year. Silent Spring documents the detrimental effects of pesticides on the environment and in particular on birds. Carson accused the chemical industry of spreading disinformation and public officials of accepting industry claims uncritically. When Silent Spring was published, Rachel Carson, an accomplished marine biologist, was already a well-known writer on natural history, but had not previously been a social critic. The book was widely read, especially after its selection of the Book of the Month Club, and inspired widespread public concerns with pesticides and pollution of the environment. Silent Spring facilitated the ban of the pesticide DDT in 1972 in the United States and many other countries that followed. Silent Spring has been featured in many lists of the best non-fiction books of the 20th century. In order to celebrate the 50th anniversary of Silent Spring, I will explore the significance of this book with Mark Wilson, a PhD candidate at the University of Northumbria in Newcastle, England. Mark has written an original master's dissertation which investigates the different response to Silent Spring in the United States and Britain. This dissertation is based on research which was conducted at the Institute for Environmental History of the University of St. Andrews in Scotland and for which Mark received a distinction. I spoke to Mark in my office at the University of Newcastle. Mark, welcome on the podcast.
Thank you.
It is often claimed that Silent Spring was the beginning of the modern environmental movement. To me, that sounds like a gross overstatement because of all the conservation work and the action against pollution that has been undertaken in Europe and North America since the 19th century. So, is Silent Spring the beginning of the modern environmental movement? And if so, what was different about this book than what came before?
I would say that kind of the book's probably more easier to read than previous books. It's written for pretty much a non-scientific audience, and Carson was already a best-selling author before she wrote Silent Spring. In terms of, is it the beginning of the modern environmental movement? I think the term modern is important because is it the start of the environmental movement? No. The modern one, it depends on your definition of modern, but from the post-war kind of more protest, environmental protest movement, it probably is. But Carson plays a lot on 19th century thinkers about ecology, Darwin. She rallies against kind of industrial capitalism, bringing in bits of Marx. So she's not kind of something new under the sun, as it were, but rather a continuation of those. Having said that, she does kind of bring everything together in a good volume, and which is quite short and easy to read, which I don't think kind of previously people have done. It's interesting, Murray Bookchin wrote Our Synthetic Environment, which was published just a few months before Silent Spring, and that talks a lot about what Carson talks about. He uses a lot of the same sources, but he was a lot less well received, and he's a lot more radical than Carson is. He talks a lot about, in order to solve environmental problems, he needs to solve social problems first. But Carson appeals to a lot more wider audience, I think, and maybe his arguments, which today seem logical, maybe his arguments at the time were, it was a lot more technical for the general public to understand.
Where was he published? Which country?
Oh, in the United States, I think. It was the start of 1962. He actually published under the title of Lewis Herber, and he was an advocate of social ecology, which is really looks at kind of, I suppose, kind of social justice and environmental justice, kind of combining them together. So you can't have environmental justice without social justice, and you can't solve environmental problems without solving social issues as well. So I think Carson really, whilst she's not the first person to talk about this, and indeed in my thesis I mention a writer from the start of the 20th century in America who was also criticised a lot like Carson, really. She wrote about big business and the Pell's a big business. Ida Tarbell, who researched the Standard Oil Company, which is part of the Rockefeller Empire. So in 1902, she presented the report to her editor, which was a history of corruption in illegal business deals. And Tarbell really is a pre-runner 50 years later, was accused of sensationalism and ignorance, a lot of the stuff that Carson was accused of. And it was frequently said that she was not a businesswoman and only a writer. Carson, it was said, you know, she wasn't a proper scientist. So I don't think Carson particularly, in terms of her writing about environmental issues, was new. What was new about her style of writing, the fact that she was able to bring all these different kind of ideas together into one book and make it readable to the general public rather than just kind of a scientific audience.
So in a way, you explain the success of Silent Spring because she wrote for the general public, and that was very successful.
Yeah, I also think kind of the success really stems from the context of the time. I mean, the post-war period in America, pesticides had just come on the general market to the general public after it being used by the military during the Second World War. So all these new chemicals available for public use, maybe not with that much instruction, so people would just take them and do what they particularly wanted with them on their gardens or whatever. And at the same time, you had a huge increase in affluence in the post-war period and a consumer society and a very much a technological society. But at the same time, you also had the Cold War with nuclear fallout, which is a big part of Carson's book. The first chapter talks about a town devastated by some unknown kind of ecological disaster, which plays a lot on the idea of nuclear fallout. She doesn't explicitly state that, but it kind of molds the two. What she's actually referring to is a town that has been blighted by overuse of chemicals, but she infers to the fact that it is sort of experiencing nuclear winter, so to speak. And so there's this strong connection between nuclear fallout and kind of looking at the dangers of pesticide use. And I think as well, there was, in America, you had a lot of nuclear fallout, radioactive waste from the test bombs. The general public as well became increasingly concerned about where this radiation was going and discovered it in the milk of cows. And so something seemingly as healthy as that, they began to question, you know, this is kind of unseen stuff. We're drinking this stuff and we don't actually know it's there. And it's something similar to Silent Spring in terms of the pesticides are in the food chain or whatever. You know, we're eating the stuff. We don't actually know it's there. We can't kind of necessarily taste it, but it's still kind of affecting us. And I think it's this fear of kind of the unseen kind of environment. The government and the chemical companies, when they kind of dropped all these atomic bombs, there were kind of farmers in Utah who claimed that kind of test bombs there had affected their cattle, but the government just said, no, you know, that's not it. We don't know what has caused it, but it wasn't our bombs. And so people began really to question kind of scientific and government authority, you know, is what they're saying actually correct? And what Carson does in her book is she says, you know, well, you should question government, you should question scientists. They are not necessarily God. What they say is not kind of fact. You should, you know, just read something and say, is that actually true? And I think kind of looking Carson in the broader context of post-war kind of affluent society, and in relation to that also the increase in technology, but also the kind of Cold War and the aspect of fear and the fear of the unknown and the fear that we might get wiped out tomorrow, I think really that explains its success. I don't think really you can just say it was the book itself, but rather the wider context. And if it had come out before the Second World War or even maybe 20 years later, it might not have had the same effect as it came out when it did. The early 60s is vital. You know, you don't have the test bomb treaty when it was published. You've got mass media as well, to a certain degree. You don't have the internet, and television's only becoming increasingly more popular, but people are much more aware about the world as a whole and what's going on.
So what you're saying, in fact, is that in the United States, there was very much a bottom-up response to Silent Spring from the general public. Yes. So if you contrast to Britain, what was the response in Britain to the book?
In Britain, it was a lot more top-down response in terms of coming from the government. When the book kind of was published, a lot of scientists in the government said, we already know a lot of what she's saying. We already have kind of measures in place to deal with it. There was the a voluntary agreement between kind of chemical companies that worked quite well, which basically, when they wanted to put a new chemical on the market, they would hand over a dossier to the government, and two different committees would look at this folder, which included information about any kind of potential experiments for long-term health problems, that toxicity, kind of the amounts kind of that could be used, that kind of thing. And on these two committees, no representative from the chemical companies sat on them at all. And it was, they were quite stringent in terms of their safety procedures themselves, because they didn't want some small firm to come on the market and darken their name, in the fear that the government would then legislate to a stronger degree than they were already watching. So they policed themselves to quite a high standard, which they didn't really get in America. At the same time, you also had, prior to 1963, when Silent Spring appeared in Britain, in the late 50s, so you also had the spraying of grassy verges in urban suburbia Britain, and people began to notice the birds were dying after these things had been sprayed. So there was a correlation between the two. In 1961, the RSPB and the British Ornithological Trust set up a research looking at the relationship between spraying of seeds and birds dying, and it was found that spraying seeds in spring was made illegal or banned because birds ate the seeds in spring, but you could spray them in August when they didn't eat them. When this was put forward in America, the companies rubbished it, but in Britain it was thought that, you know, it's not either the bird's health or our health, it's both, you know, it's not an either-or situation, whereas in America it was seen in an entirely different light. You also had the bizarre relationship between bird lovers and kind of conservationists or animal welfare activists on the one hand, and on the other hand, landowners and hunters and shooters, who both had kind of the same interest in terms of preserving wildlife, preserving bird stock, for different reasons. But both of those kind of two elements of kind of society, maybe the upper classes and the middle or lower middle classes, at the same time kind of saying, you know, we need to do something about this. The reaction to be different than in the United States. That's not to say it was totally devoid of the United States. You had some of the similar, the counterculture kind of here, you had the women's movement that kind of developed in the United States, but you didn't have the whole process of the civil rights movement, which plays a lot into kind of environmental activism that comes about after Carson. You've also got the historic link between kind of environmental protection in Britain and, I suppose, kind of legislation, in terms of it goes back to the 19th century. So in the 19th century, you know, in London you had things like the Great Stink, which resulted in kind of sewers being put in London. You had the the Great Smog in 1952 in London, which then resulted in the Clean Air Act. So they had kind of a whole history of kind of combating pollution. That's not to say America didn't, but the situation's slightly different, really, with the Industrial Revolution having started here in Britain. And a lot of the charities kind of go back to the beginning of the 19th century, whereas in America they tend to date from the late 1900s to the start of the 20th century. So you had a lot more kind of, I think, campaigning kind of aspect in Britain, so that it was treated as a different deal. And in Britain, simply, they used less fertiliser in the first place than in America, so they didn't have the same kind
pesticides.
Of problems. Pesticides, sorry. They didn't have the same kind of problems as they did in the United States. And a lot of the time, the British scientists were amazed at the US response, just the blanket spraying of gardens and whole vast areas, including private land, just to kind of eradicate insects, whereas in Britain they took a lot more localised kind of approach.
Do you also think that the tradition of the gentleman scientist, as well as the role of, you can say, the aristocracy, the upper classes in Britain, which are much more powerful than the United States, is important here?
I do, yeah. I mean, Prince Philip was a big player in kind of the response to Carson. He wrote to various government departments and asked, you know, have you read this book? He read the book and very much enjoyed it. When Carson died 2 years later, in 1964, he sent, the biggest wreath in the church was from him. There's kind of letters in the National Archives that he writes to government departments saying, what are you doing about kind of, you know, have you read Silent Spring? What are you doing about kind of pesticide use in Britain? And after that, there's frantic letters between different kind of government scientists and different, saying, what are we doing? Can we get some information back so we can kind of give him? So I think that kind of pressure as well, and the pressure to be shown doing something, is important. There's a situation where I think the Conservative Minister for the Environment, Lord Hailsham, at one point in Parliament stands up and says, the book's not that good, you know, it's badly written, it's not very good. But then the Duke of Edinburgh writes to him, and in his letters he says, oh, it's a very good book, and oh yes, I'm very, and, you know, she doesn't exaggerate at all, when in Parliament he said she does. And I think, you know, that kind of really shows some of the, you know, we really have to kind of do something with people like Prince Philip kind of putting pressure on. It does kind of help matters. I think there is a debate really looking at kind of class and the environment in terms of the aristocracy do, you know, as well, kind of going out hunting. So you kind of then kind of question how far are they kind of, I suppose, naturalists. Darwin kind of went out and killed a lot of things in his. So there is kind of a tradition of that, but all the same, kind of in the 60s, you know, I think Prince Philip was chair of WWF, was kind of still kind of hunting, indeed is today, although he claims he's kind of culling and not killing animals. But I think the debate is there about how far kind of they can be called kind of environmentalists. And I am no doubt about that he kind of certainly helped in the Britain's response to it, but I think it's kind of debatable about how far you can say that they are fully kind of environmentalists and whether or not they have kind of vested interests, if you will, in terms of kind of preserving bird life so that they can just go out and shoot them all.
It also seems to me that the public response, and I'm not talking about the powerful and, you know, the people at the top of society, is much more mute than in the United States. Is it also due to the fact that there were other publications that had a bigger impact in the UK than in the United States who came out around the same time?
In Britain, certainly the late 60s or the 70s, you've got things like the Population Bomb. That's obviously more American, but things like the Blueprint for Survival in Britain and the Limits to Growth from the Club of Rome. And these kind of really debates kind of circulating. I mean, the Blueprint for Survival from Edward Goldsmith was 1972, but he started the Ecologist magazine in 1970, and that really calls for a huge radical change to society, moving away from kind of hugely industrial kind of society to more localized, almost back to nature approach. And of course that kind of leads back to kind of the end of the 19th century, William Morris's News from Nowhere, which kind of, you know, he's not talking about pesticide use, but he's talking basically about kind of getting rid of government and just basically having he was a utopian socialist, but basically going back to nature and having a lot more kind of back to basics kind of ideas. And from 1945 as well in Britain, from the 1940s, you had the organic food movement. The Soil Association was formed in 1946. Obviously played a big role in kind of debates around kind of the use of chemicals in farming, not just kind of pesticides and fertilizers and that kind of thing as well, but pesticides is part of that debate. And you know, kind of people advocating kind of, you know, we use a more holistic, a more natural approach rather than kind of pumping all these kind of chemicals in. And I think kind of obviously acre on acre, Britain has a lot less farmland than America, and so they're going to use a lot less kind of chemicals. And they've got less mouths to feed at the time as well. And I suppose in the immediate post-war era as well, they've still got rationing, so food is limited. So, you know, they don't have the same kind of, whilst they do have a kind of a consumer growth, they don't have the same level of consumer growth as America. So I think that kind of, you know, ordinary people in Britain are a lot less muted just because I suppose they've got other things to worry about. I mean, they're still kind of worried about, they don't have the same kind of things as well, like nuclear fallout. You know, there's no nuclear tests in actual Britain itself, whereas obviously in like American states like Utah, Nevada, I think in Nevada some of the soil is still radioactive in the Nevada desert, and so they don't have that kind of same those kind of same issues that maybe play in the kind of minds of people. So when the book kind of gets published, it's not got the same kind of, I suppose, radicalizing effect as it had in the United States.
But the book had an influence because of the, you can say, scientific and political elite was convinced that this was an issue that had to be tackled. So in the end, it leads to legislation and regulation of pesticides. What do you think is the relevance of Carson's book today? Because, you know, these issues kind of seem resolved. But is there still a relevance in that book?
I think Carson herself actually says that, you know, if she hadn't written the book, somebody else would have done. If you look at her book today, it's talking about an event that kind of we know a lot more about. Kind of, you know, you still get eutrophication today with pesticides and fertilizers flowing into rivers, kind of causing algal blooms. You still get kind of wildlife deaths caused by pesticides, and the pesticide debate today is still hugely a hot topic because you've got place like in Africa where, you know, people are concerned, do we use DDT, which is the specific pesticide that Carson argued against, do we use DDT to get rid of malaria? And there's people who say, yes, use it, and people who say, no, don't. And so it's very much still a hot topic today. I think in terms of kind of Carson's book, if he read today, I don't think it would have nearly the same impact as it did then. And I think that other equally important events of the 1960s, things like the population bomb in America, you know, you had the Santa Barbara oil spill of 1969, you had other kind of environmental disasters, there was the Torrey Canyon sinking in Britain, well, probably did more to environmentalise and politicise people about environmental issues in Britain than Silent Spring did. It was certainly the first Britain's first kind of maritime environmental disaster. But, I mean, if you're looking at kind of the history of pesticides, or you're just looking at kind of how bad pesticides are, I think Carson is a good book because she tells it in almost a fiction manner. She tells it in almost a story way. So the fact is in there, but it's sort of hidden amongst kind of her more narrative, more novella writing style. Having said that, she has been criticised for being one-sided. What Carson doesn't do, and what a lot of her critics do is I don't think she really writes off all pesticides completely. I think what she does do is simply say, you know, you need to think carefully about using pesticides, you know. If there's no other, you know, if there's no other way kind of to use them, yes, use them, but use them in a controlled manner. Whereas I think most of her critics just said she's anti-pesticides at all. And she's anti-pesticides in terms of it being a first choice, but if it's the last choice, I think she would be fine to use them in a limited quantity in a specific situation rather than kind of a blanket use. And so I think her book is still relevant in terms of it bringing something to the debate of are pesticides good or not good, but I think, you know, she's just one of many books, even published in the 60s and the 70s, on environmental issues that talk about similar things. I mean, Murray Bookchin's book, Our Synthetic Environment, says much of what Carson's saying about kind of pesticides and about wider environment issues. So I can't really single Carson out as saying this is the one book that everybody should read, but I think it is important to look at in terms of the historiography of environmentalism.
It's still relevant if you look at the GM debate today, because the same issues are attached to that. We don't know what's going to if you use it indiscriminate.
Yeah, yeah.
So in that respect, it's a very important book that still rings a bell.
Yeah, a lot of her science is scientifically fact, you know, and we still don't know the full link between kind of what causes cancers, you know. So do these pesticides cause kind of cancer? And it's very difficult to say yes or no, they don't. It's a very difficult thing to say, is this a carcinogen? I mean, you look at the current kind of debate about climate change, you know, is climate change happening? There's, you know, huge stuff. And her book's not about climate change, but it raises some of the similar issues in terms of, you know, I mean, she's saying, you know, question scientists, question government scientists, always kind of question and just make up your own mind rather than listen to people say this is happening or this isn't happening, you know, just kind of make up your own mind. And what I think the book does highlight is the difference between the scientists, and almost there's a division between the chemists and the biologists. Now, it's not exclusively, there are exceptions. An entomologist in Britain actually is against Carson, but largely, by and large, most of the biologists who read her book are in favour of it, and most of the chemists aren't. And I think that really kind of represents kind of sort of biologists maybe having a better understanding of nature. They tend to work with it more kind of in their everyday work, whereas chemists tend to deal with molecules and maybe are one step divorced from nature and kind of the effects of these things on the natural world. That might be a bit too simplistic, but I do think you see kind of in the reviews of Carson's book, a lot of the biologists support her arguments, and a lot of doctors and kind of medical staff, and a lot of the chemists or the chemical engineers don't. And that might have something to do with the kind of companies that a lot of them work for, but it is kind of striking to see so many kind of scientists on one side and the other side. Whereas you look at debates like global warming, the vast majority of scientists, or climate change, so the vast majority of scientists accept that it's happening. But again, with GM, you know, the science is divided. Is it, you know, wonderful kind of creation, or is it kind of, is there some hidden peril there? And again, kind of, you know, the scientific community is divided on this.
So in that sense, we could almost write, you can say, a history of the future here about what GM is going to do, and phrase it in terms of Rachel Carson's book and the debate surrounding pesticides. Yeah. Well, that's something historians, I guess, will work on in the near future. Well, thank you very much for joining me.
It's not a problem. Thank you.
On the Environmental History Resources website, you can find some relevant links to Silent Spring-related material and further reading. And on this note, we have come to the end of the show. Remember that you can follow this podcast and the website on Twitter at eh-resources. I hope that you enjoyed listening and that you will join me next time for another exploration in environmental history. This is Jan Oosthoek from Newcastle upon Tyne.